Welcome to today's reading of the Midland Reporter Telegram and the Odessa American, read by volunteers and staff. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand at recordinglibrary.org.
This is Dave, and I'm reading from the Midland Reporter Telegram, Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. This is Section A, the front page. The headline reads, Coronavirus Consequences. Coronavirus cases in Midland County surpass 700. A man in his 50s is 15th county resident to die during pandemic, by Stuart Doreen. The end of June ended with another single-day record of coronavirus cases and the 15th death inside Midland County. The Midland Health Department reported 50 new confirmed coronavirus cases, a new single-day high total, and the fifth time since June 19th that a single-day total has been reported. These 50 cases bring the total during the pandemic to 701. When the month started, the Health Department reported 129 cases during the previous 2.5 months. The Health Department also reported the 15th COVID-19-related death and the third this month. The male in his 50s, who was being treated at Midland Memorial Hospital, died Monday. The statistics released Tuesday provide more insight on the impact coronavirus had on the community in June. The stats show younger Midland County residents made up the new cases, with 49, and younger making up 73.8% of the cases. People in this age range made up 46.5% of the cases before the start of June. Those residents in their 20s and 30s who have tested positive now make up nearly 50% of all cases. Community transmission was the common source of exposure in June with 245 cases. Just those cases were nearly more than double the total number of cases headed into the month. Contact to a known case is still the most common source of exposure with 316 cases. The number of patients isolating from home ended the month at 503. The number recovered reached 156, or 22% of the total confirmed cases, and the number in the hospital jumped from 2 to 20. The Texas Department of State Health Services reported that Midland County went into the month tied for 52nd in terms of the number of total coronavirus cases in all counties inside the state. The DSHS website shows Midland County finishing the month with the 32nd most number of cases. This article is entitled, Odessa Bar Owner Joins Lawsuit Against Governor Abbott, by Caitlin Randall. Odessa, the owner of Big Daddy Zane's in West Odessa, and about 20 other bar owners sued Governor Greg Abbott on Monday, arguing his executive order to shut down their businesses is unconstitutional. Gabrielle Ellison made national headlines nearly 2 months ago after Abbott's first order to close bars when she was arrested for violating the mandate, and six men were also arrested for carrying rifles outside her bar during a protest. Establishments were allowed to open earlier this month, but then Abbott announced Friday that bars would be required to close their doors once again in response to a statewide spike in coronavirus cases. Restaurants also were required to take a step backward, returning to 50% capacity. Ellison said in an interview she had not closed Big Daddy Zane's and would not be closing the bar. "I'm not shut down," she said. "I did not close and I won't close." The main objective of the lawsuit for Ellison is to be able to keep her bar open without fear that she, her employees, or her patrons could face charges, she said. "Am I worried about it? Sure," she said, when asked if she fears being arrested again. "But my freedom is worth it. If I go back to jail, I go back to jail." This is the second lawsuit against Abbott's executive order that Ellison has been a part of. Another suit was filed in March, then with the Texas Supreme Court on May 13th, arguing Ellison's arrest as well as requirements for masks, gloves, and social distancing are unconstitutional, she said. Big Daddy Zane's will be holding an event on July 4th to protest Abbott's order and to celebrate Independence Day, Ellison said. She said it will begin at 4 p.m. and will be kid-friendly. Ellison said other bar owners and members of the Open Texas and Open Carry Texas will be coming to the event. though this time they'll leave the guns at home. This article is entitled, Voting for Hospital Tax Runoffs Starts Strong, by Stuart Doreen. Anyone expecting a low turnout for the current elections taking place inside Midland County might be in for a surprise. The Midland County Elections Office reports that 706 people cast a ballot in person during the first day of early voting for both the Midland County Hospital District sales tax election and party runoffs. The number of voters was fewer than 100 difference from the first day of early voting for the March primary elections, and that total doesn't include those who voted by mail. In the hospital district election, that was 877. In the Republican and Democratic primary runoffs, those voting by mail has reached 863. It has been surprising, said Midland County Elections Administrator Carolyn Graves. A good surprise. The hospital district is asking Midland County voters to raise the sales tax in city and county by 0.25%. The money would be used to help offset expected cuts in the district's annual Medicaid supplement reimbursement. One election that is comparable in terms of turnout was the 2009 hospital district bond election. In that election, total turnout during early voting and on election day reached 8,228. In terms of the primary runoffs, there are two statewide races on the Democratic Party ballot for U.S. Senate and Railroad Commissioner. On the Republican Party ballot, there is one race, a local contest for judge of the 142nd Judicial District between David G. Rogers and Mary Baker. The Midland County Election Office reported Tuesday that Republicans are again dominating turnout. On Monday, 625 Republicans voted in that one race, compared to 81 Democrats on their two races. The gap isn't as large for mail-in voters, as 249 Democrats had mailed in a ballot versus 614 Republicans. That means of the 1,569 people to cast a runoff ballot through Monday, 78.9% have been Republican voters. This is the local and state page. This article is entitled, Texans for Natural Gas to Fly Banner of Thanks Over Midland-Odessa, by Mella McEwen. Many events have helped show appreciation for essential workers, from those in the medical field to those who deliver packages, stock grocery shelves, or prepare food in restaurants during the coronavirus pandemic. Texans for Natural Gas decided it was time to thank the essential workers in the oil patch who are responsible for producing the energy that powers medical devices and kitchens. So the group hired a plane to fly over Midland, Odessa on Monday afternoon with a banner thanking oil field workers. We wanted to do something big, and what's bigger than an airplane with a banner, said Elizabeth Caldwell, spokeswoman for the grassroots organization that advocates for oil and natural gas. The reason we decided to undertake this is we saw how essential workers across Texas and the U.S. were being thanked, she said in a phone interview. We wanted to thank our oil and gas essential workers and make them feel appreciated. Like any essential worker, oil and gas workers are putting themselves on the line to keep energy flowing. She said that's important as more people work from home using more electricity for such things as Wi-Fi, heating and cooling, and more transportation fuels are used for increased deliveries, she said. This is the first time the group has done this, and while other producing regions in Texas could appreciate the banner, it was flown only over Midland-Odessa, Caldwell said. The oil and gas industry is going through incredibly tough times right now, but I'm confident the industry will recover. It's resilient. Oil field workers are resilient. It's tough going, but roughnecks are even rougher, Caldwell said. The banner featured several hundred signatures affixed to the banner in the shape of Texas that the group had gathered online. We're happy to get the message out, thanking oil and gas workers, Caldwell said. This is the opinion page. This column is entitled Trump's Rhetoric Driving Away Swing Voters, by Mark Thiessen, Washington Post Writers Group. If President Donald Trump wants to understand why Joe Biden has clear leads against him in swing states such as Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin, he need look no further than his rally in Tulsa on June 20th. The president did not once mention George Floyd or express solidarity with peaceful protesters marching for racial justice. His speech was combative, defiant, and no doubt thrilled his supporters. But it contained barely a word designed to persuade anyone who was not already persuaded to support the president. To win in November, Trump can't just rely on the enthusiasm of his base. He needs to win suburban swing voters. In 2016, he won the suburban vote by 5 percentage points, and those same voters gave him his narrow margin of victory in states such as Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, North Carolina, and Florida. While many of those voters defected in 2018 to give Democrats control of the House, they had been planning on coming home to Trump this year. A New York Times Siena College poll in November found that almost two-thirds of voters in six battleground states who cast their ballots for Trump in 2016 and then voted for House Democrats in 2018 planned to back the president in 2020. That has changed. In the wake of recent racial unrest, Biden, the presumptive Democratic nominee, has opened a commanding 25-point lead over Trump in the suburbs. Two-thirds of Americans say the president has made racial tensions worse since the killing of Floyd in Minneapolis on May 25th. Trump's uncompromising rhetoric and retreats are driving away swing voters who don't want to be associated with a senior citizen shouting, "White power." There is still time for the president to turn things around, and he has one thing going for him. The economic recovery is happening sooner than anyone expected. We were supposed to lose more than 8 million jobs in May, but instead the economy created 2.5 million. Economists predict we will see similar jobs numbers in the coming months, and that the economy will grow at a 20% or even 30% clip in the third quarter and continued double-digit growth in the fall. That means Trump will likely be riding a wave of great economic news going into November. With the economy regaining steam, Trump can ask swing voters, "Do you want to keep this recovery going, or will you risk it all by putting Democrats in charge?" It's a question that will resonate because despite his negative poll numbers, the one area in which voters still trust Trump way more than Biden is the economy. Many Americans who don't approve of Trump know it is in their own self-interest to re-elect him. But Trump has to give those voters permission to vote in their own self-interest. Right now, he is not doing so. Meanwhile, Biden is giving those voters permission to defect. He is positioning himself as an inoffensive moderate who has pushed back against his party's socialist bent, saying we need to reform, not dismantle, the police, and embracing incremental change on health care by rejecting Medicare for All in favor of a public option. Biden has risen in the polls not despite his isolation, but because of it. The less he speaks, the less likely he is to commit gaffes that eventually call into question his mental acuity. Eventually, Biden will have to come out of his basement, answer media questions, and debate Trump. When he does, the race will tighten, and Trump will seek to define the former vice president as a Trojan horse for socialism who will wreck the economy just as it is coming back. But making Biden unpalatable won't be enough for Trump. He needs to make himself more palatable to reluctant voters by leaving his tough rhetoric with expressions of empathy and compassion. Each time he rightly criticizes the mobs defacing our nation's monuments, he needs to say that he supports peaceful protesters and their cries for racial justice. Each time he criticizes Democrats for wanting to defund the police, he needs to talk about his support for police reform and criminal justice reform. Each time he tweets about law and order, he needs to tweet about racial reconciliation. Last fall, when the economy was strong, Trump unveiled a new campaign theme when he declared, "Whether you love me or hate me, you have got to vote for me." If he does not stop inflaming and start uniting, millions of Americans will say, "No, we don't." This column is called Guest View. It is entitled, "It Will Be Deadly If Leaders' Actions Don't Match Their Words." by the Houston Chronicle. Vice President Mike Pence wore a mask before he spoke this week at First Baptist Dallas in the middle of an alarming coronavirus upswing, urging the people of the Lone Star State to put health first. All before an indoor, closely seated audience of more than 2,000 people, few of them wearing masks. Did we mention the 100-person choir? This dangerous model was more fit for Mixed Message Monday than the church's Celebrate Freedom Sunday event that brought Pence to town. It was in keeping, though, with the mismatch between words and actions by state and federal officials who continue to endanger lives and force retrenchment on the very economic recovery they've ceaselessly punished. Last week, President Donald Trump, who refuses to wear a mask in public, gathered about 3,000 people in Phoenix in violation of the federal government's own safety guidelines. The same day, Texas GOP officials announced the party was going ahead with its in-person convention in downtown Houston. About 6,000 people are expected, and masks would not be required. Arizona and Texas are two of the states that are breaking records in the number of new infections and hospitalizations for COVID-19, a situation that will not improve until the current failure of leadership ends. The number of daily new cases in Texas hit a high of almost 6,000 infections last week, and hospitalizations have steadily increased since June 12th. As of Sunday, Texas has almost 150,000 cases and 2,400 deaths reported. Governor Greg Abbott has recognized the perilous position the state finds itself in, and last week reversed part of the economic reopening that began May 1st, shutting down bars and limiting restaurant dining to 50% capacity. He has also allowed counties to order that businesses require customers to wear masks. There are important measures that should be recognized. But this seesawing between open and close, between giving the false impression that we're doing fine and calling people to not leave their homes, will only further hobble the economy and put Texans at risk. To be truly effective, Abbott needs to find the political courage to buck irresponsible elements within his own party, including Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick, who went on Fox News last Thursday to minimize and obfuscate the state's alarming numbers. The outbreak has worsened to the point where suggestions and recommendations will not be enough to keep the situation from deteriorating. We'll say it again. Abbott must order statewide mask use for all Texans when they are outside their homes and near others, or free up local leaders to determine what restrictions make sense in their communities. He must lead or get out of the way. Successfully navigating the pandemic demands more from our leaders than politics as usual. When dealing with COVID-19, the gap between words and actions is not only hypocritical, it is deadly. This column is entitled U.S. Has Emotional Reaction to Masks by Tyler Cowen, Bloomberg Opinion. While Americans still have not adopted mask wearing as a general norm, we're wearing masks more than ever before. Mask wearing is mandated in California, and in many counties, masks are near universal in public spaces. So I have started wondering, does wearing a mask change our social behavior and our emotional inclinations? And if mask wearing does indeed change the fabric of our interactions, is that one reason why the masks are not more popular in the United States? When no one can see our countenances, we may behave differently. One study found that children wearing Halloween masks were more likely to break the rules and take more candy. The anonymity conferred by masks maybe make it easier for protesters to knock down so many statues. And indeed, people have long used masks to achieve a kind of plausible deniability. At carnival festivals around the world, people wear masks, and this seems to encourage greater revelry, drunkenness, and lewd behavior, traits also associated with masked balls. The mask creates another persona. You can act a little more outrageously, knowing that your town or village a few days later will regard that as a different you. If we look to popular culture, mask wearing is again associated with a kind of transgression, Batman, Robin, and the Lone Ranger wear masks, not to keep their true identities a secret, but to enable their ordinary selves to step into these larger-than-life roles. But if we examine mask wearing in the context of COVID-19, a different picture emerges. The mask is now a symbol of a particular kind of conformity and a ritual of collective responsibility and discipline against the virus. The masks themselves might encourage this norm adherence by boosting the sense of group membership among the wearers. The public health benefits of mask wearing far exceed the social costs. But still, if we want mask wearing to be a stable norm, we may need to protect against or at least recognize some of its secondary consequences, including the disorientations that masks can produce. Because mask-wearing norms seem weakest in many of the most open societies, such as the United States and the United Kingdom, perhaps it is time to come to terms with how masks rewrite how we react and respond to each other. If nothing else, our smiles cannot be seen under our masks, and that makes social interactions feel more hostile and alienating. It may lower immediate levels of trust in casual interactions. Plenty of negative, hostile claims are circulating about masks to the point of seeming crazy. But rather than just mocking them, perhaps we need to recognize what has long been called the paranoid style in American politics. If we admit that mask wearing has a psychologically strange side, we might do better than simply to lecture the miscreants about their failings. Just ask yourself a simple question. If someone tells you there is a new movie or TV show out, and everyone in the drama is wearing masks, do you tend to think that's a feel-good romantic comedy or a scary movie? In essence, we are not asking Americans to live in that scenario, but not quite giving them the psychological armor to do so successfully. On the brighter side, I wonder if mask wearing might diminish some expression of intolerance. People who might feel that others are looking at them funny might find themselves with less to be offended by as masks obscure those micro-reactions. Common mask wearing is already reportedly easing the public judgment experienced by Muslim women who wear face coverings in Western society. Some Muslim women who wear the niqab report that they are no longer being given dirty looks, if only because they no longer stick out so much. Women who cover their faces for religious reasons may now be ahead of the rest of us when it comes to effective communication, because they cannot rely as much on their faces to convey emotion in public conversations. They report relying on more visible body language, such as waving and gesturing. The tension of current mask policy is that it reflects a desire for a more obedient, ordered society, for public health purposes above all. But at the same time, it creates incentives and inclinations for nonconformity. That is true at least within the context of American culture, admittedly an outlier, both for its paranoia and its for infatuation with popular culture. As a society, our public mask wearing is thus at war with its own emotional leanings, because it is packaging together a message based on both discipline and deviance. What we can do to convince people that a mask-laden society, while it will feel weird and indeed be weird, can be made stable and beneficial through our own self-awareness. While there is no simple answer to that question, mask advocates should recognize that they have been treading into unusual cultural territory and should not be surprised by unusual public responses. This column is distributed by Tribune Content Agency. This is the obituary column, Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. Dorothy Dot Barlow Moore. Dorothy Dot Barlow Moore passed away on June 23rd, 2020 in Midland, Texas. A memorial service will be held Tuesday, July 7th in Savannah, Tennessee, under the direction of Shackelford Funeral Home. Visitation will be from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m., with the service beginning at 1 p.m. Dot is survived by her son, Bruce B. Moore, Sarah Jane, grandson, Beau Moore, all of Midland, Texas, and daughter-in-law, Mackie Griffin Moore, granddaughter Amy Porter and great-granddaughter Mackenzie Ree Seneff of Richmond, Kentucky. Preceding her in death were her husband of 56 years, Paul F. Moore, her son, Greg Moore, her parents, and 11 siblings. The family would like to express their gratitude to the staff of Midland Memorial Hospital and Hospice of Midland for their excellent and compassionate care of our mother. The family requests that memorial donations be made to the Texas Scottish Rite Hospital for Children Foundation, 2222 Welburn Street, Dallas, Texas, 75219-3924, and Hospice of Midland, 911 West Texas Avenue, Midland, Texas, 79701. Local arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland, Texas. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Death Notices. Anthony Eugene Slaughter. Anthony Eugene Slaughter, 45, passed away on June 24, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Anthony was born on June 27, 1974 to Hope Slaughter in Midland, Texas. A funeral service will be held on Wednesday, July 1st at 11 a.m. at American Heritage Funeral Home in Midland. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory. Freda Louise Black. Freda Louise Black, 82, of Midland, passed away June 21, 2020. Private family graveside service will be held Thursday, July 2, 2020. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Sammy Ray Cheney. Sammy Ray Cheney, 72, of San Angelo, passed away June 28, 2020. Graveside service will be held at 11 a.m. Thursday, July 2nd at Rest Haven Memorial Park in Midland. Arrangements are under the direction of Nallie Pickle and Wells Funeral Home and Crematory of Midland. Online condolences may be made at www.npwelch.com. Stephen Knippers. Stephen Knippers, 73, of Midland, passed away on June 27, 2020 in Midland, Texas. Stephen was born on March 25, 1947, to Bernice and Douglas Knippers in Tom Green County, Texas. No services have been scheduled at this time. Arrangements by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory.
Hello, I'm Jesse. I'm reading from the Odessa American for Wednesday, July 1st. The fourth in the time of COVID. The story was written by Michael Bauer. COVID-19 or not, Americans are ready to start celebrating their freedom this week as fireworks stands all over Ector County have opened for business. What isn't clear is how sales will be affected by the pandemic. Ryan Wyatt, who works at John's Bombs, which has two locations, one at 7111 Andrews Highway and 6918 North County Road West, isn't sure about whether or not sales will be high. Quote, "We don't know," Wyatt said. "It's so hard to predict what people will do. We've had some rain. It's been crazy." End quote. Most fireworks stands opened up on June 24th, but John's Bombs didn't open until Saturday due to a COVID-19 scare. Wyatt said, "We opened up on Saturday because one of the workers came into contact with someone who tested positive for COVID-19. But after the test results came back negative, then we opened up," Wyatt said. This is Wyatt's second year working at John's Bombs, but there will always be some items that sell more than others, and it should probably come as no surprise that the biggest sell at John's Bombs is the shell fireworks. Quote, "That's one of our biggest sellers," Wyatt said. "A lot of the kids' stuff, we sell a lot of them, too. We sell a bunch of packages. There's a combination of sparklers, showers, and artillery shells. It just depends on the packages that you buy. They come in a variety of packages," end quote. They also do giveaways each year, too. Quote, You can fill out a raffle ticket where you can win The Godfather, which is the biggest package that we have, Wyatt said. Packages are usually the popular sellers at stands. That's been the case for one stand that's run by the Odessa First Assembly. Their stand, which is located at 2679 South County Road West in Odessa, has seen a few packages sold, including one called The War Zone. Quote, "We sold about three of them," said Cheyenne Maloney. "It has artillery shells. Another hot item is the assortments. We have this cool backpack for kids. It has a bunch of different items for kids, like sparklers and pops, and the kids get a backpack," end quote. Maloney says they've had their fireworks stand for at least 6 years. Quote, "Every year is different," Maloney said. "For instance, this year, we don't normally sell as many as we have already. This season, it's been different. That's one of the more expensive items," end quote. They've been following strict social distance and face mask guidelines. Quote, "We obviously have been wearing our face masks," Maloney said. "It's difficult because of the six-foot thing. A lot of the times, people won't be sure about what they want, and usually you can hand them the product, but in that instance, you're face-to-face, so we've implemented them to wear face masks. We have hand sanitizer at every register," end quote. Maloney added that the proceeds that they make go towards sending their youth students to summer camps and to support missionaries. They said business was quiet at first, but it has since picked up a little bit. Quote, "It's usually pretty dead when we first open, but I don't know if it was because of COVID," Maloney said. "But we've been pretty steady. People are ready to get back out," end quote. Maloney said that another hot item are Roman candles, as well as the sparklers and the tanks. Wyatt says it's been quiet at John's Bombs as well, but they anticipate that it will pick up as the week progresses. Quote, "It's been a little bit slow, but his busiest days are going to be the third and the fourth," Wyatt said. One of the customers, Jose Cirilla, who is picking up items from Mr. W's Fireworks, which has multiple stands all across the county, says he always comes to buy fireworks each Independence Day, but added that they aren't spending as much this year as in the past. Quote, "The budget and everything has been crazy," Cirilla said. "People used to spend hundreds of dollars to spend at fireworks stands, but it looks like this year people are spending $20 instead. But we understand that there are people who have it much worse," end quote. Cirilla, who says his family usually travels to places like San Antonio or Dallas for the 4th of July, will be staying home this year due to the pandemic. Quote, "Pretty much we just want to stay safe," Cirilla said. "We wanted to go out and travel on the 4th, but we've canceled that due to the rise in cases," end quote. But like with every year, there are still some restrictions on what can or cannot be shot off. Quote, "For the bigger fireworks, you have to be outside of the city limits to pop them," Wyatt said. "For the smaller things, you can do in your backyard," end quote. Mobile tests went quickly. The story was written by Michael Merlo. After 125 people signed up for the majority of tests an hour before Tuesday's City Mobile COVID-19 testing began, city officials are telling residents to show up early to future events. City of Odessa Public Information Officer Devin Sanchez said in a phone interview that, quote, "It was early by the time 200 tickets were given out, and she heard that some people had arrived as early as 6 a.m. for a test." As Ector County residents arrived to Sherwood Park for the testing, they were handed out tickets labeled 1 through 200 to ensure efficiency. 200 tests are available at each Odessa mobile testing, and those who showed up to Sherwood after all the tickets were given out were told to go to the other mobile testings, Sanchez said. Quote, advice for the next event is to show up early, she said, referencing the Thursday testing at Woodson Park that will start at 11 a.m. and end at 1 p.m., adding that she thought people would be in line at around 8 a.m. The mobile testing began in part by the state and city concerns, which focused efforts to offer free coronavirus tests in underserved parts of the community. With the amount of people turned away during Tuesday's testing, Sanchez said that, quote, we kind of changed our messaging a little bit from anyone who wants a test to come out to anyone who needs a test to come out, end quote. Quote, we want to make sure that everybody who needs a test, who has been exposed, or who is exhibiting symptoms receives that test, she said, adding that what the city doesn't want is people to just get a test because it's free. Quote, if you have not been exposed or you have no reason to believe that you have COVID, maybe sit this out. There will be other events, but let those people who truly, truly need it obtain a test, end quote. Sanchez said that there is no pre-registration and there is no way to tell if people are from those neighborhoods where tests are being conducted. But she said that if people, quote, can obtain a test another way, if you have the means or you are insured or you have a way to obtain a test a different way, there are people in our city who cannot, end quote. The tests for uninsured patients at certain Odessa urgent cares can run up to around $350, and Sanchez wants people to ask themselves if they are taking the opportunity from people who truly need it when they sign up for a free test. She went to the first testing as a spectator and says she felt the people who showed up to get tested were the people who needed one in that community. She said that she hoped people who were turned away will try to get a test on Thursday. Quote, the last thing we want is for anyone to have it and continue to spread. We're doing this to try to slow down the spread of this virus in our community, end quote. As clinical pathology labs saw a spike in tests last week, Mayor David Turner said that the first Tuesday and Thursday tests would be able to get into those labs just fine, but that he was concerned with delayed results for those future tests. Sanchez said that the Tuesday and Thursday tests aren't going to bypass any of the recent lab time restraints, but that CPL would take the Tuesday and Thursday test specimens. She also said that after a phone call with CPL Tuesday, labs will be able to accept all the scheduled tests and the city will be able to continue all the test dates as they were originally scheduled. Sanchez said she wanted to remind people attending the mobile testings to wear masks, to bring a form of identification, not to bring any family unless they are being tested, and if a child is getting tested, to let them know what they are in for before they have to get swabbed. A representative from an Odessa CPL declined to comment on how they are dealing with a surge in tests. Sanchez said more information would be available later regarding the lab that the city of Odessa is using to process the mobile testing. More information regarding the city mobile testing can be located online at tinyurl.com/y8a8hz8r. A Tuesday Ector County press release detailed that the county will also be conducting free COVID-19 mobile tests this week for those turned away from the Tuesday and Thursday city tests. Tests will take place from 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. today at Kellis Turner Park at 2230 Sycamore Drive, and another test will take place at the same time on Thursday at the South Ector County Volunteer Fire Department. The release detailed that those getting tested must be Ector County resident and must register for the test at tinyurl.com/YA7WODY9 or call area code 512-883-2400. Quote, due to overwhelming scheduling of appointments, website and phone number may be unavailable at this time. However, you can still go to one of the locations and you will be tested, the release stated. New Hayes Principal Can't Wait for Challenge. The story was written by Ruth Campbell. Longtime teacher, coach, and administrator Paula Donheim will be taking the helm as principal of Hayes STEAM Academy starting today. Donheim served as Hayes' assistant principal and has been with the district for about 27 years. She worked with Principal Julie Marshall, who is set to become principal of Dowling Elementary School. Marshall starts today as well. STEAM stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. A native of Crane, Donheim earned a Bachelor of Science degree in Health and Kinesiology from Sul Ross State University and a Master's degree in Educational Leadership from the University of Texas Permian Basin. Quote, at first, I was wanting to go into sports medicine, and I ended up coaching. I coached here in the district for about 10 years. I coached girls volleyball, basketball, and track, she said. After coaching, administration seemed like the natural step to take. Quote, I always loved the classroom. That's really where my passion is. And then I felt I could make a difference by becoming a curriculum coach, so I did that for a few years. And once I was comfortable with that, it just felt comfortable to be an assistant principal. I just felt like I can make that next step and make a difference. Then that's what I need to do, Donheim said. In junior high and high school, Donheim played any sport she could find. Quote, I enjoyed the competition, she said. Her competitive spirit and coaching ability will help her when she takes on the principalship, she said. Quote, if you are a coach and the kids run the play wrong, you automatically stop the play and you make corrections and do it again. You continue to practice it until that skill is refined. If you think about it, the classroom is the same way. If you make a mistake, we show you where the mistake is and try again, Donheim said. She added that becoming principal at Hayes is a distinction she is proud of. Quote, this school has such high expectations and the academic program is so rigorous, it's an honor to lead this group, Donheim said. The campus has 30 teachers and just under 400 students in pre-kindergarten through fifth grade. Donheim has worked with Marshall for 2 years. Quote, and what's funny is when I originally decided to go full-time into the classroom and stop coaching, I began at Zavala Elementary, and Julie Marshall was actually my mentor teacher at Zavala when I went into the classroom. So we've known each other for a very long time. She's an amazing leader, Donheim said. The feeling is mutual. Quote, Paula is a strong leader who always makes decisions based on what is best for the kids. The Hayes community is blessed to have her as their leader, Marshall stated in an email. Alicia Press, an executive director of leadership for ECISD, said Donheim is a gifted educator with years of faithful service to ECISD. Quote, she has demonstrated throughout her diverse career the ability to continue to lead Hayes on the strong path that has been established, Press said in an email. Continuing the quote, I am looking forward to working with Ms. Donheim as she takes on this new challenge, end quote. Donheim was part of the Aspiring Leadership Academy, where assistant principals acquire skills to become successful school leaders. The COVID-19 pandemic curtailed the Academy's final project presentations, but Donheim's venture became a reality in the form of the Emergency Daycare Center at Zavala for the local medical community. The closing date for the daycare center was June 26, Donheim said in a June 25 interview. Quote, "When we applied for licensing, it was an emergency certification, so it's only good for 60 days, so the closing day is tomorrow, June 26. It's basically two facilities in one. On my side, where the ECISD kids are, we maintained about 37 students per day, so we had paraprofessionals in the classrooms running that. We had links on the lesson plans so that all they had to do was click on a link, and their plans were right there for them and easy to follow," Donheim said. Some children were at the center for only a few hours, and others stayed for 12 to 14 hours, depending on the parents' needs. Some parents were working 12-hour shifts. Parents were thrilled that the district furnished the center. The district provided breakfast, lunch, and an afternoon snack to children while they were there. Quote, "They loved that we provided the service. They were extremely grateful for it, and we were happy to be able to provide it. It's just one of those services that, why wouldn't you do it? That was a no-brainer. They needed it, and we were there," Donheim said. Donheim said that the academic program at Hayes focuses on using depth and complexity in all subjects. Scholars delve into a well-rounded curriculum that includes arts, PE, science, and engineering. AVID, or Advancement Via Individual Determination, is integrated throughout the campus. Positive Behavioral Interventions and Supports, and CHAMPS, a system of expectations that works with rules, rewards, or consequences, implemented the Minds in Bloom website. Conscious discipline is also used to cultivate emotional intelligence through self-regulation. Quote, "The newest initiative that we have this year is blended learning. Hayes received a blended learning grant for grades pre-K through 2. We're really excited, but when you think about it being perhaps virtual, that adds a different element," Donheim said. She added that it is supposed to work better if it is face-to-face and virtual. Quote, "It's an approach that combines online and opportunities to interact. So basically, it requires the physical presence of both the teacher and the student with some elements of online, so there are elements of control over your time, place, path, and pace," Donheim said. In taking on Hayes, she'll at least be in familiar surroundings. Quote, "I feel much more at ease because it's just going to be a seamless transfer. I'll be able to pick up right where Miss Marshall left off, and we'll just continue building. She involved me in all the decisions, everything being rolled out, so there are no surprises as far as what we're already doing," Donheim said. "I'm excited. I can't wait," she added. COVID-19 news. By the numbers, Ector County total cases, both confirmed and probable, 900. Ector County negative, 5,494 out of 7,740 tested, with 1,346 pending. 7 deaths. Recovered, 336. Active, 562. Midland County, 701 confirmed cases, 15 deaths. Texas, 159,986 confirmed cases, with 2,119,036 tested. Total Texas deaths, 2,424. U.S. cases, 2,581,229 total confirmed cases, and 126,739 deaths. Find out more online at co.ector.tx.us or dshs.state.tx.us or the CDC site at tinyurl.com/tzrjlf. Here are some Odessa American quick hits. ECISD offices closed for 4th. ECISD offices will be closed in conjunction with the July 4th holiday. All Ector County ISD schools and offices will be closed Wednesday through Friday in conjunction with the 4th of July holiday. The district will resume regular summer operations July 6th. As a reminder, ECISD summer hours are 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Thursday through the week of July 20th. Back to school donations. First Basin Credit Union has officially kicked off the 5th annual Back to School donation drive, benefiting children of the Rainbow Room of the Permian Basin. While there are many unknowns of how classes will look in 2020-2021, First Basin wants to ensure that children are prepared with what they need under any circumstance. First Basin is requesting monetary donations be made at any FBCU location in Odessa, Midland, or Andrews, account number 80001-01. First Basin will kick off the drive with a $500 donation. All monies raised will be presented to the Rainbow Room to purchase what the students will need as school districts make plans known. The Rainbow Room works with Child Protective Services, CPS, and helps foster children and all other children involved in CPS care throughout Midland, Odessa, Andrews, and surrounding counties. Donation deadline is July 31st. For information regarding the school drive benefiting the Rainbow Room, call Janet Sotelo, Community Engagement Coordinator, at 248-1443. City Trash Schedule. The City of Odessa has adjusted the trash schedule for this week since the city will be closed on Friday for Independence Day. Household hazardous waste facility will be closed Friday and Saturday. They will reopen on July 7th. Thursday rollout carts will be picked up today. Friday rollout carts will be picked up on Thursday. Residential brown dumpsters will be serviced once. Apartments and commercials will be serviced twice. Visit www.odessa-tx.gov.
Hello, this is Michael, continuing the Odessa American for Wednesday, July 1st, 2020. Man charged with stealing church van and burglary. A 33-year-old man was arrested after he reportedly stole a van from a church and attempted to use that van to steal floor tile from a remodeled home. Julian Carrasco was charged with burglary of a building, a state jail felony, and unauthorized use of a vehicle, a state jail felony. The reported incident happened around 6:58 a.m. Sunday in the 2700 block of Brazos Avenue, an Odessa Police Department affidavit stated. When officers arrived at the scene, Dylan Weaver reportedly told police that a house he has been remodeling had been entered. Weaver stated the person who entered the house had his vehicle stuck in the mud in the backyard. Carrasco was seen standing beside the van in the backyard, the affidavit detailed. Carrasco stated he was trying to get the van unstuck from the mud and that he needed help getting the van out of the mud. The van was reportedly a 2012 white Ford Econoline, and after officers ran the license plates, it showed it belonged to Crescent Park Baptist Church. At the time, the van hadn't been reported stolen. Officers made contact with Carrie Bren, a trustee at the church, who stated that the van was missing and no one had permission to use the van. the affidavit stated. The van had a busted-out passenger window, and the ignition had been tampered with. Officers reportedly checked the van, and they saw tile in the back of the van. Weaver stated the tile in the van was from inside the residence. Weaver also stated that Carrasco was using a shovel that was from inside the residence to attempt to get the van unstuck from the mud. Investigation showed Carrasco's shoe prints were found inside the residence, and Weaver stated that he didn't know Carrasco, nor did he have permission to be inside the property. Carrasco was arrested, charged, and transported to the Ector County Law Enforcement Center. He has two bonds, totaling $10,000, and was still in custody as of Tuesday morning. Jail records show. Obituaries from Wednesday, July 1st. Brad Harvey Lineman, Carlsbad, New Mexico. Brad Harvey Lineman, 50, beloved husband, brother, and uncle, passed away on Saturday, June 27th, in Carlsbad, New Mexico. Brad is preceded in death by his parents, Louis and Louise. He is survived by his wife, Misty, his siblings, Carol and Stephen, nephew, Ryan, nieces, Sarah and Elizabeth Aza, great-nephew, Jaden, and great-niece, Harper. A small service will be held Friday, July 3rd at 9 a.m. at Sunset Memorial Gardens on the grassy area behind the mausoleum. Social distancing and masks are requested by the family to protect several family members that have compromised immune systems. Due to state limits of crowds, we can only have 50 people in the tents, but additional people may stand outside the tent in socially distanced groups, or you may sit in your car parked around the area, or parking is available in the area west of the grassy area, and listen on your car radio tuned to FM 104.9. A live stream of the service will be available at sunsetodessa.com for those who cannot attend. Arrangements are entrusted to Sunset Memorial Gardens and Funeral Home. Please visit the online guestbook to share memories of Brad and condolences for the family, also at sunsetodessa.com. In lieu of flowers, the family has requested memorial contributions to the Salvation Army. Death notices for Wednesday, July 1st. Stephen Nippers, Midland. Stephen Nippers, 73 of Midland, died Saturday, June 27th in Midland. No services have been scheduled. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Anthony Eugene Tony Slaughter. Anthony Eugene Tony Slaughter, 45 of Midland, died Wednesday, June 24th in Midland. Funeral service is scheduled for 11 a.m. July 1st at American Heritage Funeral Home. Arrangements are by American Heritage Cemetery Funeral Home Crematory of Midland. Dorothy Faye Price Lyons. Dorothy Faye Price Lyons, 80 of Odessa, died Sunday, June 28th in Odessa. Services are scheduled at a later date. Arrangements are by Acres West Funeral Chapel of Odessa. Patrick C. Rodriguez. Patrick C. Rodriguez, 31, died Monday, June 29th in Odessa. Services are pending with Martinez Funeral Home and Crematory of Odessa.
We've been reading from the Midland Reporter-Telegram and the Odessa American. Please stay tuned for the weather, followed by the second hour's reading of the newspapers.